diving. Hope comes and stops us in our tracks. Bravely we prove in our striving, trudging together each day. Where there's a will, there's a way.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the 100th episode of Raw Recovery. Not even my guests knew that. I didn't even know that. I just remembered. But welcome. We are a Trudging Together podcast. My name is Dion, and I'm going to be the host today for you. Welcome back. This is my third podcast this week. I hope you are enjoying the Big Book Thumping series that I've been putting out. That is a series about the first 63 pages. And I cover it like I would with a sponsee. So you better get that highlighter out because you're going to be highlighting stuff. Today, I have a good friend on. Kel, welcome to the show. And thank you for taking your time.
Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So Kel and I have the same home group. Is it 3 p.m. your home group?
Yes.
It is? Okay. But either way, we go to the same meeting and we've gotten to know each other for, gosh, I think it's been a year and a half now.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. You know, and we've actually planned this a few times, but the thing is when it comes to things like this, it's done in God's time. It's really the only time that matters. Because otherwise, whenever we try and force anything, it includes our own will, our expectations, and we don't get the same effect. So I think I've already done plenty of talking. We all know how my show works. And you know what? I thought this was cool. I saw Russell Brand and Jordan Peterson. They were doing a podcast. Russell Brand tells Jordan Peterson, he says, "No, this is your podcast." And I thought to myself, he stole my idea. I'm just kidding. All right. So I'm going to hand the show on over to Kel. Kel, welcome to the show. Raw Recovery is now yours.
Oh, okay. Well, Raw Recovery is always mine, right?
Yeah.
And yours.
Yes.
As I was telling you earlier, I really would like to tell my story. It's unusual in a couple of ways. Like, okay. I was sober for a long time, and then I drank, and then now I'm sober again. So that was kind of strange. And when I first got into recovery, it was for something else. For sure, this program saved my life. So a little bit of background.
Okay.
I don't talk about this a whole lot, but it is relevant. I grew up in an environment that was a little hostile.
Okay.
So there was, without going into overmuch detail, like there was every kind of abuse. Every category of abuse, I should say.
And if people don't know categories, that'd be physical, emotional, mental, and let's not forget about spiritual. It is one of them. So
yeah, well, and also sexual abuse. So
yes.
That
okay.
one as well. So there was all of that, and I also like ran into some pretty serious like bullying when I was a kid.
Okay.
So I want to say I was kind of feral, but I spent a lot of time outdoors and spent a lot of time trying to avoid other people because, you know.
I didn't like them, and they didn't treat me good. They were just, I never seemed to get along with people my age when I was growing up.
Yeah, so I mean, the other thing that I wanted to emphasize, because this is a part of my story I don't tell a lot, but it's so important.
Okay.
When I was a kid and I was going through all of this awful stuff, right? Okay. To add to that, I won't go into detail, but like I am trans and I'm not straight.
Okay.
And I grew up in the Southeast.
Oh,
and it's
okay.
sort of like That was a little bit of a challenge.
Okay. Were you in the Bible Belt itself, or were?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
The thing that I want to emphasize is I was brought up with religion.
Okay.
The religion that I was brought up in, again, it didn't gel very well with me, as a young woman, with musical training and stuff. I wasn't ever allowed to lead anything or lead any singing or anything, but they would let 13 or 12-year-old boys get up and do it because they were men and they could do that. None of this stuff really ever sat right with me. And but okay, I had a concept of a higher power for as long as I can remember. When the stuff got really bad with my childhood, like I was getting the bullying, I was getting the abuse, and all of the stuff was happening. I really didn't have any safe places. I mean, I would pray every night for this stuff to stop. And it didn't stop. I would pray that I could handle it better. I would pray that I could, be the gray rock and not respond, like when people, physically assaulted me or did whatever they were doing. And it was just a complete fail. Like it never, I nothing ever happened as a result. I lost faith in a higher power when I was probably, probably by the time I was 12.
I imagine it was going to be pretty young.
I also, this is kind of interesting too, because I don't hear a lot of people who say this. When I was growing up, I thought my father hated me, and I didn't understand that he loved me until I was like a teenager, and I never felt really anything like love for him until I was like older and like out of the house, just because of how I was treated. And when I would tell people that matter-of-factly, because I was like, well, yeah, he does this and this and this, like he hates me, I try to avoid him, and they would just be like, oh, and I was just like, oh, what, that's not normal,
Yeah, because to
so
you, it seemed normal.
yeah.
But real quick, did you have any brothers or sisters, or were you an only child?
I have two older siblings.
Okay. I was just curious.
Yeah, I'm the youngest.
Okay. And were you the scapegoat? Were you the black sheep of the family then, or?
I don't know. I just know I was different.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. Like,
And I get that.
I mean, the addiction was part of it. Like my first addiction, my primary addiction is not to alcohol. I started, it's I guess what you would call a process addiction. So process addictions are things like sex addiction, food addiction, like addiction to like ripping paper, stuff, cleaning, stuff like that. So I started one of those like when I was like around 12, and I was really kind of heavily involved in that, addiction, like pretty young. That continued, I don't know, it continued until I got sober when I was 22. And as far as alcohol went and drugs, when I was younger, like when I was a kid, that stuff wasn't really in the house. When I was a teenager and my dad was in his 40s, he did begin drinking again. So and by then but by then I was like mostly not living there. But I really didn't have access to substances when I was like younger, but when I was in my like late teens and early 20s, I did some drinking. My main focus was like on my other addiction. Like I don't know how to describe this, but I felt like I couldn't breathe without it. And so I just continued to like find any way that I could to escape. I was very lonely, and again, really didn't have a good solid concept of a higher power that was gonna something that would work. not just something to think about or a good idea, but something that would actually, like a faith that would work, a higher power that would work. Then, okay, so this is kind of fun. So my addiction when I was around 20, 21 years old kind of came to a head.
Okay.
I was with a guy who was at that time, if you will, he was my supplier for my addiction.
Okay.
And I was really, really like in love with this dude. He broke up with me and I just like wanted, like I wanted to kill myself. Like I was just like, oh my God, like it was awful. So I was talking to a friend who, you know, is in a 12-step program and he says, you know, the way that you talk about that person, it kind of sounds like an addiction.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, well, maybe there's a program for that. Maybe there's a program for this thing that I do, like this behavior that I can't stop and can't control. Yeah. And it turns out that there was, and that there were meetings. And so less than a week later, I was in my first meeting. And it was not an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It was another meeting. But when somebody first started sharing, they were sharing about like my addictive behaviors. And I was like, I have found my people. Like, it was really the first time in my life where I felt like I could, there were people that I could, that could completely relate to me.
Yeah. And probably one of the first spots where you felt at least halfway safe. You know, I can't deem that AA or any 12-step group is actually a safe space, but it certainly is safer than anywhere else I had been.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly perceived it that way. And the program was very helpful. There were a couple of other things that I didn't mention that I probably should before I talk about this. So I guess I'm what you would call cross addicted. I also kind of grew up, this is odd. Here's where I was. So I'm 20, 21 years old. I'm getting into recovery. Like I'm trying to figure out what this addiction thing is about. Yeah. I was so relieved because it wasn't just that I was like messed up or whatever. It was like, I was an addict. This was an addiction. Like it was classically an addiction.
Oh yeah.
And I was just like, oh my gosh, there's treatment. There are other people who have this. There's help available. This is great. You know, the other thing, though, is that I feel I'm one of those people who was born without a conscience.
Yeah, I understand that.
Now, I still think that I maybe natively am that way, but I'm not that way anymore. I have lived the principles long enough that I feel I have a conscience, but I feel I was born without one.
Yeah,
and up until I got into recovery, I did not understand what love was.
Exactly.
Okay.
Dave, you're right.
And here's why. I would say I loved people when it was appropriate. I would try to love people. I could not do it. My relationship was with my addiction.
Yeah.
It was my everything. It was my boyfriend, girlfriend, my mother, father. It was, you know, it was my everything. It was what I lived for. And I felt that living without it would be both impossible and just not worthwhile. So when I got into recovery, one of the first things that happened, so I found out that one of the first rules is don't use, right?
Yes.
About a month or two after I started going to this other program, I also started going to AA.
Okay.
And that was for two reasons. First, if I didn't drink, I was less likely to do my other addiction.
Yes.
Second, AA is widely known, and everybody that I talked to said this, had the best and most solid recovery program.
Yeah.
And I was very interested in that. And so I learned, first of all, you don't use or you don't drink or whatever. And then, I started learning kind of about the fellowship. And one, there, I'm not going to go into it, but I did a lot of really kind of bad things when I was a kid, not to other kids, but just bad behaviors in general that are regarded as extreme by psychologists. Like I said, I was being abused. I was under a ton of pressure, but I didn't feel anything. Only I felt too much because I was getting bullied. But then I did this other behavior so I wouldn't feel anything. You know what that's like, right?
I
So
know exactly that feeling.
the first significant thing that happened after I got into recovery and getting sober and being sober for a couple months is that not only did I get my feelings back, I gained the ability to care about something other than myself. And that was incredible. If anybody who hears this, or if you don't have that ability to feel empathy for others, I know what that's like, and I feel very sorry for you. It is a very, very lonely existence.
It is, when, because our drinking and our addiction get to a point where we're so numb, we're just indifferent to everything. We're not surprised by it. Well, this is gonna kill you. And it's so what? You think I don't know that? No, leave me alone. I want to be by myself, alone in my misery. But then there's this other part of me screaming for help.
To connect.
Yeah, for connectiveness, but my brain won't get away from me. Yeah,
I yeah, it's tricky stuff. So I'm not going to gloss over exactly my first 17 years, but I just want to give a couple highlights. Like, so I was sober both from alcoholism and from my what I call my primary addiction. I've been sober since April 1st, 2002 in that addiction.
Okay.
And I've never
Good job.
slept, which was cool. I'm grateful for that. I mean, the thing is, it's like the cravings for that. I mean, alcohol is like nothing. I mean, that the cravings for that were really bad. The withdrawals were really bad. I just don't want to go through that again. So anyway, I'm not going to completely gloss over those first 17 years, but so I got sober from both addictions in 2002 or from alcohol and whatever. I didn't really believe that I was an alcoholic or that I had an alcohol problem. Okay. So meanwhile, a couple states away, this is going to be important later. Okay, when I was a kid, my father was an amateur bodybuilder. He was really, really strong and he got really, really ripped. And when he was in his early 40s, I think his early 40s, he started drinking and he had not drunk before. His father was a pretty bad drunk.
Hence why
pretty
you
bad.
did.
Really, so he avoided it, I think. My only thought was maybe he avoided it for most of his life. And, he said that he drank to get to sleep. Anyway, he started drinking in his early 40s. So, I so around, I got married in 2011. In 2013, I watched my, former like strong, healthy, 6 foot amateur bodybuilder of a father, shut down from all of his organs like failing in the hospital at age, I believe he was 64. And his body was just like, I can't handle the alcohol anymore. His organs just started going, dude. So that was my experience of alcoholism at the time.
An alcoholic death is, and I'm not assuming he died drunk. I don't want to do that. But
Well,
it's never
I mean,
great.
yeah, he'd been sober for like maybe a week or two, but dude, too
Okay,
little too
well,
late.
give
But
it to
go
me.
ahead, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, it's just, again, alcoholic death. I mean, this is just so people know, this is usually what happens. This is how most alcoholics die. What happens is you drink too much alcohol, and then you have what's called a delirium tremens. And you will go into a seizure, whether you've had seizures or not. You'll fall on the floor, and then you'll asphyxiate on your own vomit. That's an alcoholic death right there. And if
Yeah.
that's what you want in your life, and if that's how you want, it's how Jimi Hendrix went out. It's how Janis Joplin went out. We've lost a lot of people that way. I've had a lot of friends who, asphyxiated on their vomit.
So this is what I learned, and this ties into what you just said, man. This is what I learned from that. The young addict, like, I don't know, like Jesse Pinkman doing meth with his friends in Breaking Bad, and like the people on TV having a glass of wine with whatever, and like the people who are out like shooting up and partying and stuff. That person is the same as the old addict dying in the hospital because their body can't take it anymore. They are the same person, just with time. You are gonna get there if you're one of us. That's gonna be your fate if you
And
don't get
that's,
help.
the thing is, and this is when we say that alcoholism is a progressive disease, okay? This is what we mean. Because if you don't get into recovery and start working the 12 steps, your alcoholism will continue to progress whether you drink or not. You just not
Oh,
need to
yeah.
rest it or do anything about it. But if you just get sober, no, your alcoholism is still progressing.
Right. So, and that leads me to seamlessly into the next part, which is like when I lost my AA sobriety. And so here's what happened. I never stopped going to meetings. I just stopped going to AA meetings. I'm still in another fellowship. I actually host meetings for that fellowship and stuff. So, but I was going to maybe like, I don't know, 1 to 4 meetings a month. I really wasn't doing a lot of them. I was super busy. So what happened was, in 2018, I got divorced, and I consider it the greatest failure of my life. Because okay, in AA in the early 2000s, there was this dude named Don. And he said, he was a speaker at our meeting one night, and he said, "The one thing that you will never get back is time." He said, "You might get money back, you might get your family back, you might get your relationships back, you probably will get your health back. That time you will never get back." I wasted a lot of time that I should not have wasted there. And that is why it's my biggest regret. So that happened, and honestly, it sort of broke me. In late 2019, I remember it was October, and I've struggled with migraines for a long time. I had a really, really bad migraine. I told my partner at the time, I'm thinking about drinking again. Like, I don't really think I had an alcohol problem. I'd like to try it. And he was kind of like, he didn't seem to think that it was the best idea ever, but he's real hands off, which I love. Well, I had this really bad migraine, and I went to the liquor store and I got some Everclear, and I got home and I drank a couple ounces, followed by like 4 ounces of water, and that's why I started drinking again. I was trying to escape pain, and as we all know, alcohol is not really an effective painkiller, especially not long term.
No, it's a dissolution. It'll make your life a delusion and it'll dissolve it. It's a poison.
Yeah. Good. I mean, real good times. Here's what happened. I thought that I wasn't an alcoholic. I thought that I did have an addiction, but it wasn't to alcohol. And I started drinking again. And at first it was all right, but it quickly progressed to being within 6 months, I'd say. I was drinking every night to get to sleep in my early 40s.
Oh, sound familiar? Yep.
So the irony, I didn't see it until my
That's a
husband pointed it out.
generational cycle, is what we call those.
And it's so funny. I have super bad PTSD partly because of my father, and he had super
Sure.
bad PTSD because of his father and couldn't sleep, and like I can't sleep either.
Yeah.
It's just so it's hilarious. Anyway, so here I am in my early 40s drinking again. A couple of months after I started drinking, here comes the pandemic. So anyway, within about 6 months, I'd say I was drinking nightly to get to
Oh,
sleep. Here's where I my story differs from others, and I want to emphasize this from others that usually that I hear people say. I did not experience cravings for alcohol. Like I've experienced, for example, for sugar. When I eat sugar, like sometimes it awakens a craving and it's like I want to eat the whole bag of whatever it is, right?
yeah.
But I didn't have a lot of that with alcohol. I drank out of a measuring cup. I did strictly control the amount that I drank. And,
Okay.
I always drank a ton of water right after it because I didn't want people to smell it on me. I have a really good sense of smell. I'm what you could call a super smeller.
Okay.
So I was always real paranoid about that. But so what started happening, I didn't crave it, but I also didn't stop.
Yeah.
Could have, but I didn't. And I started, so a couple of things started happening pretty quickly. I only drank for two, actually, I drank for less than 2 years. A couple of things started happening pretty quickly. First, I started having the shakes at night. I refused to get, I refused to drink when that happened because I was pretty sure that the shakes were like my body detoxing from the alcohol, and I'm like, I'm not pouring fuel on that fire. But it really scared and upset my husband, and I feel really bad about that. I did go to a doctor and get seen about it. I started having other problems too, just kidney stuff, just other stuff. Lots of I tell people my addiction was a lot of sadness and vomit. So, I was throwing up a lot.
Oh, man.
I don't know. I slept all the time. I was always either sleeping or trying to get to sleep. I was working from home. So the good news is the one thing that really didn't suffer was my career because I've never had financial help as an adult. And it's very primal for me. Like if I don't work, I don't eat, right? So that's one thing that never suffered was my career. Thank goodness. Like I didn't, I, my job didn't suffer, but it was only a matter of time. It would have
Oh,
eventually.
absolutely. Yeah, it's a yet is what we call those.
Then so there was a host of health problems. There was all this. Somewhere in the middle of all that, I moved to Colorado. Because it had been my dream for a long time. I was still working from home, still working for the same company, but then I was located in Colorado. And so here's where we were at that point. I'm going to talk about like the up until like the month that I got, or I'm going to talk about like around the month or two before I got sober because that's when stuff started getting really bad. All right. These are a few warning signs that I should have noticed. Just a couple. The time that I threw up in the bed while I was passed out. Dude, I could have died. I knew that. I somehow was just like, oh, well, that sucks. I guess I better clean this up. And then I lost time. There were a couple of days in July of 2021 where I was very angry at somebody and I drank at them. And
The
yeah, I
fuck
lost a weekend.
it's.
And like I looked at my phone and it was Friday, and then I looked at my phone again and it was Sunday.
Wow.
Then the next month, which was August, I again lost a day somewhere in the middle of the month when I was drinking. Don't remember anything that happened. I had plans which I didn't make it to. And and before I tell you this last thing, the one other thing that I want to kind of emphasize is that even when I was drinking around other people, for me, it wasn't about the other people and the fun. It was
Oh,
about
no.
me feeling drunk. So when I was interacting with other people while drinking, that was what that was about. Like I really wasn't a social drinker. I would often like sneak alcohol to places that did even places that didn't allow it and like drink it in the bathroom and
Little shooters. I'm gonna go
stuff
for a
like that.
cigarette.
So
I'll
I
be
mean,
right back.
yeah, like I mean, I mean, or did, maybe not even didn't allow it, but maybe didn't serve it, stuff like that. So, so then, all this stuff happens, health problems. I start losing time. I lose a little bit more time. Then came the incident that got me sober.
All right.
They got me sober this time. And as one other thing, my concept of a higher power was reactivated when I did my step three in 2002. I lost it again in 2007 when my friend Emily died, and she was the best person I've ever known. It didn't make sense. I couldn't believe in a higher power anymore. I still continued to work the program, but it was kind of hollow.
But it was harder, yeah.
Yeah, it was harder. So anyway, the incident that got me sober again, fast forward into 2021, was there was it was a Monday. I had, the day off of work, and I was just like, I'm just totally gonna get plastered. Like my husband had plans with his family, so he wasn't gonna, he was hanging out with his family in another part of the house, and he wasn't gonna know or whatever. And I don't remember that day anything about it, not even not how it started, nothing about it. I don't even remember the day after it. I remember, so the day that my last drink happened was a Monday. On Wednesday, I told my husband, I think I have a problem, because I was real sick after that one. On Thursday, I meekly asked what had happened to our glass coffee table in the living room.
Uh-oh.
And he said, you don't remember? Well, okay, to make a long story super short, I broke a coffee table with my face, apparently. A glass coffee table that then shattered and there was glass everywhere.
Those
My
things are
poor,
tough
oh
too.
my God, they
You must have hit
are.
it just right or something.
Something happened, dude. I don't know. Anyway, my husband heard a loud ass crash. He came upstairs, and my drunk ass was on the couch yelling at him, apparently. I don't know why. I don't remember anything about it. I don't know why I would behave that way. I've never yelled at my husband. Like, why would I do that? And so he gets up there, he cleans up all the glass, and then he hears another crash, and it's me falling again. And so then he goes back upstairs, walks my ass to bed, and puts me to bed. And I don't remember any of this. On Thursday, he tells me about this. And I was just, I don't think I've ever been, I could have melted through the floor. I don't think I've ever been so embarrassed in my entire life. And I went upstairs to my computer. I took the rest of the day off work. I said, look, guys, I got a issue I'm dealing with. I'll be back tomorrow. And I called Central Office local here, and I said, I need help. And they said, well, what do you, I was like, I need a meeting. I was like, I can't go out. I might buy more alcohol if I go out. I need help. I've got to get a virtual meeting. Can you help me? Like, and they said, well, there's one starting around, 3 o'clock, here pretty soon. So, you should go onto that one, and here's where you need to go. And I was like, okay, great. And I landed in this meeting, and I was almost hysterical because I had just found out like all of this awful stuff. And here's the thing, Dion. Even while that was happening, in the back of my mind, I knew that if unchecked, I would get drunk again.
Oh, yeah.
I knew. The bruises hadn't even healed on my face.
And your brain's already like,
already planning the next one.
Not really. The denial is so deep rooted in us. And here comes that indifference again. Not only about, but now we're indifferent about ourselves. And that is when we start, that's when we start hurting other people. That's when we get in cars and kill other people because we want to drive around because we think we know what we're doing. We're dangerous and we should be locked up.
Dion, I was so scared, man. Because like, look, I mean, that to me, that day didn't happen. I broke a coffee table and my husband could put me to bed, but I could have gotten behind the wheel and killed a family of four. I never would have even freaking known it.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just like, I just couldn't, I'd never had a blackout before, at least not on alcohol. And I was just really, really, really upset by it. So anyway, it got me into recovery.
I'm grateful because most of my adult life, I didn't own a car.
Oh yeah.
I'm not saying I didn't drive. I didn't have a car.
The opportunities were fewer.
Exactly. Or I would have, you bet.
So what happened then? That day, in that meeting, the guy chairing it, asked me to read the promises at the end. And I said, can you remind me what page that's on, man? And I read them. Yeah. And, later that night I was reading, I got numbers and everything. Like I knew how to do the thing, like jumped back in right away. I said, like, I'm looking for a sponsor, right away. I was like, I'm going to start on the steps as soon as I can find a sponsor, started attending other virtual meetings, just stayed on meetings as much as I could. Mm-hmm. I kind of, decided that if I didn't have help, like I was going to go back and like I had to do anything like to avoid that. I wasn't sure if I was an alcoholic, but then I read that sentence in the Big Book chapter 4 where it says, if when you try, you find you can't quit entirely. Yep. And I said, okay, that's me. Yeah, I said, maybe I can't identify with the craving, but I can identify with the trying to stop and can't, because here I am with the bruises still on my face and I'm already planning my next drink. I've tried to stop and I can't. Yep. And I could really, like, literally willfully, like, call myself an alcoholic and mean it for the first time. And that was, so that was one of the turning points for me. And I've had, so my experience this time around has been so different. Recovery is much easier this time.
Yeah.
There are much more tools. Since I got sober, which was in late 2021. Okay. So I've been sober like, I don't know, 2.5 years or so.
2.5 years.
And, since I got sober, I've been to, I think, 2 or 3 in-person meetings and 1 AA event.
Yeah.
All of the rest of it, has been online. Like my meetings and my service over Zoom. I meet with my sponsors over Zoom.
Yeah.
For the first couple of years I had 2 sponsors cause I got a temporary one. And then when I got the permanent one, the temporary one decided she wanted to stay.
Why not? Nothing wrong with more closed mouth friends.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've always kind of believed in sponsor by committee. Another kind of strange thing, interesting thing that happened. I had a buddy. He at the time he was my husband's best friend. He went into jail for his third DUI. And while he was in jail and then prison, I can't actually I can't remember if it was his third or his fourth. I think it was his third. But anyway, I wrote him a letter every day. And this gentleman didn't and still doesn't think he's an alcoholic, which I of course I can't say. Like that's something that only they are qualified to
Decide
judge.
himself. That's right.
But it was something that in my especially in my first year, it helped keep me sober because I try to find creative ways to do service in addition to just the usual stuff.
Oh,
And I thought,
absolutely.
well, here's a dude who has an alcohol problem. I can be helpful to him. I can write him in jail. So that's what I did. I wrote him a letter in jail every single day for the whole time he was incarcerated.
That's a pretty
And
big commitment.
yeah, I didn't send one every day. I would send them two or three at a time. So and we would also send him books, but that was about it. But I told him, look, dude, you go back again. The only books I'm sending you are AA literature. but no, he's a great, he's an outstanding guy and a good friend still.
That's great.
So anyway, so now here we are at recovery. I'd kind of like to talk about my experience with my higher power because that has been kind of the hardest thing for me to get past. And the way that it happened was different from usual. All right. The literature says, we seek a higher power. It does not say that we have to find it. I
Correct.
decided, like one day I was driving down the road and I just said the most, one of the most honest prayers I'd ever said in my life. I said, I will never stop seeking you until I find you. And then I said, even after I find you, I'll keep seeking you. And that was kind of like at the time. And that was kind of the best I could do. But I kept, I would continue to pray and meditate, even if I didn't like believe in what I was praying to, like, or didn't know what I was praying to. I would continue to do it because that's how to work the program, you know.
Make it till you make it. That's what
I
we need
mean,
there.
yeah, the first time I worked step three and became connected with a higher power, which was in 2002, here's how I did it. I was going through a book with a friend of mine. I had sponsors, but I was going through a book with a friend of mine that was, it had you circle adjectives for your higher power. And I circled loving, caring, compassionate, trustable, predictable, and purposeful. And but I said, this is what I've learned from that was around my step two and three, I learned that I had this awesome concept of a higher power, but I didn't really believe in it. I couldn't get to it, like I didn't see it being connected to me. So my friend Patrick said, take those six adjectives, insert them in the third step prayer, say it every morning and mean it. And I did. And one day I just woke up and, well, not just woke up then, but one day I was going through my day and I realized that I believed. And I came to rely on that connection more and more, and then lost it in 2007. Well, that's been kind of the hardest part about coming back is that I have friends who are atheists and agnostics and have long-term sobriety and work the program absolutely just fine. And so I was confident that I would find a higher power that worked for me, even if it was just like, well, I have faith in AA. It's an organization that it's bigger than me, and these people have commenced, as the literature says, to do something which I cannot do alone. So
That's
I
right.
kind of use that as a higher power. But
Yeah.
I always
Pretty
heard
strong.
about people who had like a connection with their higher power, you know.
That,
here's what happened. I was cleaning one day and I was thinking about my higher power or lack of thereof, and I dropped my tools and I stood really still and I
Right.
said, "It's the same stuff. How do I know you're real? And how do I get in touch with you?" And then I just listened. But the answer was already there. And I can tell you that it didn't come from me. The answer was, anytime you're connected to music, even if you're just thinking about it, you are in touch with me.
There you
And
go.
I just immediately knew it to be true and didn't question it. And then the ego kicked back in and I said, "Hold on. What if I lose my voice, my hands, my hearing, my sanity?" And the response I got was, "Did I fucking stutter?" And I
Exactly.
said, "I hear and understand." So about a week later, and this is what kind of completes this story. About a week later, I decided to put it to the test. And so I stopped whatever I was doing at the moment and I said, "If you're real, and if I can get in touch with you, what about Emily? Explain it. Make it make sense. That this woman who was born 12 days apart from me and the best person I've ever known in my life is in the ground and I'm still up." The first thing that I got was an overwhelming flood of memories. All of them had to do with music. Us singing together when we were kids, in church. Her trying to teach me how to play the flute, and I couldn't get a no noise out of it, and how she was always so envious of my talent, even though she had more money and had access to a lot more education. And after that, I got a sense of deep sadness, like the day that I found out when she died. And I heard a voice that said, "Emily died as the result of her free will. You know, I can't control human free will." And I said, "I know you can't." And it said, "She was a pilot and she knew the risks when she took the job, and she died as the result of her free will." And then I got that sense of overwhelming sorrow, and it said, "Just know I'm not somewhere outside you watching you suffer. I'm here suffering right alongside you. I'm here with you." And I thought, well, that's probably the best answer I'm ever going to get to that question.
It is.
So now
What a
I
beautiful
can,
answer, though.
yeah. So I can say I'm not really sure about my belief in a higher power. It's the one aspect of the program that I really, I guess, have the most trouble with. But
Sure.
and I've also found that there are times when I have trouble accessing my higher power, but I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think it has more to do with me.
I found when I'm blocked from the sunlight of the spirit, it's always me. It's usually an intention or a fear. It's usually one of those two things, that or I get upset because I don't get what I want, what I think I'm, fear tends to drive me on those things. And thank God we don't get less fear, we get more courage. And that's something that I appreciate. God didn't remove my fears, but I have a lot more courage. I trust in the fact that I can walk through it and then I'll be okay. I'll be all right.
Yeah, it's again, it's for me, it's still a little tenuous, but that's okay. I mean, I don't take all of the literature like literally. I don't literally believe that acceptance is, I don't take all of it literally, but one part that I really rely on and love is in chapter 4 of the Big Book, where it says, "With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you." I just don't feel anxiety about finding my higher power anymore. I just don't. I just think that if I continue to seek it, I will continue to find it. Because when we find something, it's usually because we're looking for it.
That's right. Well, and we alcoholics were extremists, and that's going to include God too.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. Yeah, we are extremists, and that includes our higher power.
I went through the same thing. I mean, is because I want to feel that connection. It's what gives me the ease and comfort that I used to get from taking drinks, and that's why I like it. But I find that there's sometimes when God's like, "Well, Dion, I think you're gonna have to understand delayed gratification because I ain't taking
I can identify with that.
it." You're gonna have to learn to let it go, buddy.
Oh gosh, I understand. Just I wanted to like there's something that I wanted to kind of drive home that I haven't really said a lot about, and that's sort of like the contrast between what it was like and what it's like now. I still have my breakup letter to alcohol, and it's pretty short, but I'm not going to read it. I want to say, on the outside, the people who knew me didn't necessarily see too much of a change because most of my drinking was done at home, like during the pandemic when we were like quarantined anyway, and but the part where I know I'm an alcoholic and where that I should have paid attention to and been honest with myself about was the part where my world had shrunk until I no longer participated in a lot of the activities I cared about, interacted with people. I worked, but other than that, I was just a person who drank, which that's funny. That's all my father did when, but until he died, was like go to work and then drink. I mean, that's really hilarious. But my world shrank until it was just drinking. Like, I love my husband and I love all of my friends, but my addiction. I tell people, there is no human love that you have that is strong enough to overcome this addiction. Not for your parents, not for your children, not for anybody. No, there is no human love that, in my opinion, that is stronger than addiction. Like none. And at I became like that. That was what I lived for, was to drink. And today I, am a practicing, musician again, and I have friends. I have several communities that I'm part of, one of which, of course, is the recovery community.
Well, and you just went on a
Different.
tour out of the country. Tell us about that a little bit.
That's right. Last year I'm in a band, and we study ethnic music primarily from Eastern Europe, but also from other regions. And we went to the country of to the Republic of Georgia in Eastern Europe, and it was pretty amazing. I always had assumed that harmony as we know it had started, in the 10th, 11th century in Western Europe. Turns out the Georgians had this stuff pretty well developed by the 7th century, probably earlier. They just went about it slightly differently, and that's what they're. But it is, I'm a total xenophile, dude. The weirder some, the more alien something is, the more interesting it is. This music is the strangest stuff I've ever heard. It's literally unique. It's one of UNESCO's, like, it's considered one of the cultural intangible parts of humanity is traditional Georgian polyphonic singing.
That's a hell of a statement.
Yeah.
It is.
And I wasn't all that much good when I was over there because I didn't really know I was going until like a couple weeks before. So I didn't have time to learn the language or any of that stuff.
Okay.
I went and I just did, you know how they say like birds fly, fish swim, alcoholics drink. Well, that's all true. Birds fly, fish swim, alcoholics drink, but also Kel makes music. So
yeah,
I kind of went over there and I did the musical interaction, but I didn't really speak the language. But like after I got home, I was a little more helpful because I could transcribe some of the strange harmonies a little easier than some people in my group.
Yeah.
Just due to my training. And that was cool.
And I think it also did something else for you. I think it actually helped you with some of your PTSD.
Oh, yeah.
I noticed a change when you came back. You were a little more calm.
Yeah, definitely.
Like you had gone through something tough and made it through just fine.
It was Georgian polyphony that led me directly to my higher power. Directly to.
You did not stutter.
Yeah, did I fucking stutter? I mean, it was pretty, you know, after I got back, one of the things that I started doing was using this music in this and this singing instead of my traditional prayer and meditation in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I really just felt like connected and just ignited from head to toe in a way that like that plain meditation had never or prayer had never done for me.
Yeah. I know a lot of people, I use music for meditation. I use weird things for meditation. I play video games.
That's great. That is a great way to meditate.
I put it on easy and I don't care if it's just something to make my brain shut up for a little bit so it can do what it needs to do and talk to God. Go pull some weeds, go for a walk, dance. Yeah. Something
nowadays they're saying move a muscle, change a thought.
That's it. Yeah, but I understand, because when it comes to God, I mean, we have nature, we have music, there are so many things with a higher power in it that's not a doorknob. Okay, I'm glad you think this anyway. I mean, I get it because we're starting small, but we got to take it kind of seriously.
Well, okay. I mean, the doorknob can't get drunk is the excuse I always heard. But go ahead. Go ahead.
That's a good point.
I didn't mean to. Yeah.
Really. And I guess a doorknob does turn, so that's kind of a change.
My sponsor said, well, then what if somebody comes and takes your doorknob away and puts it in your pocket? They put their iPod in your pocket. What you going to do now? And I was just like, oh, my God. Okay, my higher power's all doorknobs, we were just bouncing stuff off each other at that point.
Well, that's the thing about alcoholics. We're a little local in the Cabeza, and we like to have fun. And the thing is we've lived very arduous lives, and none of us got a childhood. So when we sober up, it's like being a kid all over again.
Yeah. Man, there are some people in this program who had great upbringings and like had no issues if whatsoever, but I find it's kind of rare. I think my brother might be one of those. Like he's never gotten, his addiction's never gotten triggered. Like he lives a normal life. He probably has the same genetics I do, but he's never drank.
Yeah. Well, and if he's never drank, therefore it never sets the terrible cycle.
Right. It never sets it in motion. Like he was way smarter than me in that regard. So, but I mean, most of us, to your point, I didn't mean to undermine your point. Well, most of us have had it pretty rough.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got several stories where people are like, no, I had a great upbringing. It's just that when we're born with alcoholism, you don't have a choice. You're not given a choice. So, but that's what's great about AA, whether you want to call yourself an alcoholic, a problem drinker, my first wife, I met her in AA, not an alcoholic. She was going through a phase. She did the steps, everything. I knew she wasn't an alcoholic. She finally figured it out, but my hat's off to her.
Because in the meantime, her life probably got better.
The right thing. And that's what's great about AA is we help everybody from going through phase to the chronic alcoholic. We help all of them.
I think it's the forward to the first edition where it says, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all.
You are correct. I've read that 3 times this week. So yeah.
My friend Patrick used to say, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not, but I'm definitely an all. I try to point that out to sponsees, like you said.
With people that are having a hard time, I like to go to page 21. Mm-hmm. And I say, okay, we're going to read this. And then when I'm done, I'm like, did you see yourself in any of that? Okay, because they're always over there going, yep. And so it's like, okay, you might be one of us, man. That's up to you. So, all right. Do you have any parting words of wisdom before we go?
Oh gosh.
I should always warn people that I'm going to ask them that at the end.
There was a lady I went to meetings with who used to say, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk.
That's right.
And, there's another friend that I had in the early 2000s, late 1998 and 1990s, who said, if you can't be a good example, you'll just have to be a horrible warning.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to be a good example today.
That's right. That's the best. And, you know, actions speak louder than words.
They do.
They really do. All right. Well, we've kind of come to the end, and here comes my Jerry Springer moment, what I'm going to start calling them now. And I'm going to talk about the third step here a little bit. Okay. I have found that the third step needs to be done correctly. It's always personal. It's always personal, man. It never seems to take effect right away. It happens like a week later, and mm-hmm. it's usually an epiphany or a thought, or suddenly realizing that God is doing for you what you couldn't do for yourself. For me, it was when I went to 7-Eleven and came back and didn't even think about the liquor store. Walked by it twice.
Yeah.
That's what I knew, you know. So God doesn't ask too hard of terms. He really doesn't. But he's also not going to stop you from going out and drinking. He's not going to stop you from doing that. You have to make that choice yourself.
No.
But once you do, it's very powerful. Very powerful. So thank you to all my listeners for being here. I love you. You know I do.
I love you too.
Peace out and have a day. Bye.